And we'll go from there.
I haven't received more questions for the minutes yet. I haven't started the minutes. Too many other things that I've been...
Okay.
We were talking about water coming in, water going out, and these flood events, and what I said is...
I should say this is a continuation of the interview with Don Burdick on November the 14th, 1996. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, anyway, in this stuff, we... So the water was pouring in our canal at 5,100 CFS. That does not include the water from our own basin that was coming into the reservoir.
Which was also elevated, no doubt.
Yeah, and it was high volumes from that source as well. So anyway, 5,100 coming in plus our own basin, and we can only expel about 2,400 CFS. Well, so this bifurcation will move that 2,400 up to maybe 2,760. So we've made about a 15% closure of the gap, but we haven't solved it. Mm-hmm. The advantage of just that one thing, though, is we can let water out a little faster, so by the time the overtopping occurs, we should have a lower elevation in the lake, which gives us a little more reservoir capacity. The extra 360 will slow the rate of rise in our reservoir. And it's a matter of duration. So maybe it wouldn't be as high, the overtopping won't be as high as it might otherwise be. But we're still going to get flooded and we're going to get hit, and we know that. And we are thinking about some what's called hazard mitigation on our main dam, and that is to cut off a piece of the main dam, to cut right off the top of it, and to install additional stop logs across the top of the main dam that we could just take out and increase the discharge capacity up to the 5,100 range so that at least if we get hit by the same event, we might not be able to do much to protect the upper canal, but we can do a lot to protect the main lake and the bays and the navigation level properly. We have made application to FEMA to obtain the necessary funds to do that. We would also do some additional earthquake mitigation at the same time, putting big pins down through the dam to protect against unique earthquake characteristics. We think we're protected now, but the standards today are higher than when we built the dam, and we could solve those. But FEMA is a very difficult organization to work with when you're a private not-for-profit. Their interpretation of the congressional recommendation is not always what we think Congress wanted to do. But it's, in our opinion, it's worth a try. Mm-hmm. Because we think that if we can spend $155,000 to do this improvement to our dam, which will be hazard mitigation, and we will stop $20 million worth of damages around the lake, that's a pretty good ratio. And we think it will beat many of the ratios that other municipalities propose for hazard mitigation.
Mm-hmm. This might be an interesting point to talk about the way in which all of these events interlock. You mentioned that had you taken the extreme step, which probably nobody was considering seriously, of dynamiting the dam.
No, it was it's a interesting cocktail conversation. Someone made the comment about, well, did you ever think about just blowing up the dam? And they expect me to say no, but I don't. I say, well, yes, we talked about that. And it never got to the point of a serious discussion, but we weighed the pros and cons of it.
Well, I'm wondering, when you're in the middle of a disaster like that, to what extent do you talk with and trade off with other localities that whose own situation might be impacted by what you do. I mean, I'm thinking that for instance, there was talk about the fellow operating the Skagans Dam of, you know, the decision was made there to start dumping water because that dam was imperiled. But you know, they took some criticism for doing that because, of course, that meant there was more water flowing down the Tualatin. And likewise, if you were able to dump more water off over your dam, then that mean there'd be more water in the Willamette. So how does this work out in a disaster how did it work out in the flood of 96 in terms of did you get warning from upstream there at Skagans that they were going to start dumping water, and did you give any warning to downstream communities in the Willamette? What kind of communication took place?
Well, you know, actually, that's a very interesting question you ask, and I think that I've commented several times that someone should write a book about crisis management. What are the things that happen, and what are the dynamics of the situation? And they ought to do so with people who have been through crises or been in charge of, you know, when a crisis occurred, because I think there's a lot of things to be learned. It's something you have to kind of know about before the crisis occurs to know what are the moves you should take, because oftentimes you only realize it like a bird flying backwards to you know, you can't exactly see where you're going, but you know where you've been. That's a very good question. First of all, though, regarding the Skagans Dam situation, yeah, I think that there's always a lot of false information and false rumors out there. First of all, you have to realize that Skagans Dam is a very small percentage of the water that comes down the Tualatin. I can't remember the number, but I think it's less than 10%. And in point of fact, they actually aided the flood fight because they had some excess capacity at the beginning of the flood, and they held back without dumping water. And they held back till the water got within a couple of feet, I think it was maybe 3 feet of the top of Skagans Dam. And then the choice was either we allow the water to come up and overtap our dam, which could cause a lot of damage to that dam, or we begin to let it out. So what they did is they were letting out as much as they were taking in, but that really began right around the peak and continued on after the flood. So they were a net holder of water during the total event, as opposed to being they did discharge, but by that time they were holding everything they could get. It's like a person that has a big appetite and they begin to eat a lot. Well, they get to a point in their eating where they just can't eat anymore, mm-hmm. and they better get rid of it because the food is just continuing to come down their throat. And that was the case up at Skagans. And so, to their credit, they were making the right moves. In terms of communication with other agencies, our communication was primarily right here within the Lake Oswego Basin. That was the city of Lake Oswego. And what I found was that the police department and the fire department were trying to communicate through the emergency communications network, which is one of radios and special broadcast systems and so forth. But the decision-making that was really going on between agencies and so forth bypassed that channel, and it went straight to cellular telephones. One of the comments is that the only bill that was higher than the flood bill was the cellular phone bill. I know my cellular phone bill typically runs around $25 to $30 a month. I'm not much of a user of cellular phones, but I have one. And during the month of February, my cellular phone bill was over $300 because that's what you did. You carried around your cellular phone, and when you had to get somebody, you called them on their cellular phone, and you packed it everywhere. And I remember meetings that were held in the middle of the night up by our head gate when we were worried about it, and there was a dozen people standing around, and the phone would ring, and everybody grabbed for their phone. It was like out of an old Western where they're all drawing their guns. Nobody knew whose phone was ringing. It might be theirs, and all these hands dove for a pocket as if they were going to pull out a pistol, but they pulled out a cellular phone to see if it was their phone that was ringing. And then people would kind of walk off from the group to answer their phones and discuss whatever it was, and they'd come back to the group, and the information was shared. It was the telephone calls were very short. There was very little chit chat. It was It was a decision-making environment. And frankly, there was a certain adrenaline rush going on for at least me. I had hard to talk about how everybody else felt, but I've been involved in so many business discussions, and they seem to drone on forever, and these meetings and the planning and you get bored to tears. Well, there was no boredom in this situation. I mean, people were driving around in their four-wheel drives if they had them, and operating off cellular phones and eating snack food and grabbing a couple hours sleep here and a couple hours sleep there, and it went on 24 hours a day for 3 or 4 days. It was a very interesting thing. Did we communicate with other agencies? Not a lot. I think the mayor of our city, had some communication with Portland, and then it would get passed down, you know, what was going on down there. We knew the flood fight was over down there at the time. It was still rising out here. Mm-hmm. But it was a cellular phone communication environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I remember, and in fact, I have in my notebook here, building list of telephone numbers, and we had all of our phone books and stuff of other people's offices and so forth, but all of a sudden we discovered we were communicating by cellular phone, and by the end of this thing I had 3 pages of cellular phone numbers, and they were all handwritten and not in any particular order, but just a person's name and a couple of phone calls, and you know, his house and his cellular phone number and what his office was, It was an amazing environment to operate in, I think the core decision to build a dam, which they did in 12 hours, that was within their capabilities, but we had other capabilities too. That we just made decisions and hoped that we were right, and some of these people, and speaking of communications, they had boards of directors to report to. City manager had a council to report to. There was a guy here in Lake Oswego who was the head of engineering, and he was immobilized by this. I can't quite explain the term. He was paranoid about making any decisions in the middle of a disaster. Decisions had to be made, and the number two guy in the engineering department, It kind of evolved to him to be making decisions, and he was nervous, I was nervous, other players were nervous, because we were making decisions which we felt would be in the best interest of our organizations, but we didn't really have the authority to do it. Our external authority was there. We could tell somebody to do something and they thought it was the Lake Corporation telling them. But I didn't really have the resolution from my board to be making decisions as had to be made. And I kept checking in with the president and telling her, I've done this and I've done this and I've done this, and you know, is this okay, or I hope this is okay, and will you check with the board, and many organizations, not just ours, operated on people who were making decisions in good faith that in a time of no crisis. They would never have done that without clearing it through a committee or a board, and it would have been maybe in some cases months of discussion, and there was no time for that.
Right.
It was interesting, yeah.
Well, you mentioned that there were acts of heroism on the parts of many individuals out here. I'm wondering if you have any examples that spring readily to mind.
Oh, when I say heroism, I don't mean that people put their lives at stake, but things that happen, and people who were rational, just they made a decision and they kind of I'll give you a couple of illustrations. One, our powerhouse, the water rose above the level of the floor in the powerhouse. It rose about 20 feet above the level of the floor in the powerhouse. So the water was coming in. We have some very high windows that are way off the ground, up high in the air, and the water was actually lapping at the sills of those windows. But at the door to the powerhouse, the water was maybe 4 or 5 feet above the bottom of the door jamb. And so what we had done is we had, the city kept bringing sandbags down to us, and we had built a sandbag wall, and we had pumps operating inside the powerhouse so that the water was coming in, but we were pumping it out as fast as it was coming in. And we had guys working, in effect, 20 feet underwater in the powerhouse. And if the water started spilling in, it would have filled the powerhouse with 20 feet of water, ruined all of our turbines and the equipment. But these guys were fighting to keep the water out. They had 4 or 5 lines coming in the door. Well, one of the lines pulled the sandbag wall over in one place, and the water began pouring in to the inside of the wall, and then of course across the transom and into the and down into the powerhouse. It was spilling over like a waterfall. And one of the young men, he was a junior in high school, realized what was happening. And he scrambled up the ladder. The water was coming in over directly over his body and into his face. And he scrambled up the ladder and he ran to the point and he put the sandbags back in again to stop the water from coming in. And like the Dutch boy that got his finger in the dike to save the polder on the other side. Well, I guess the heroism is that He figured out very quickly when all these adults were down there, you know, not knowing exactly what to do. This guy figured it out in a nanosecond and saved the day for us. Otherwise, we would have had 20 feet inside that powerhouse within the next 10, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. I think that there was, I think that the Stu Dunis cutting the flume line.
Oh yeah, I wondered about that.
Is in a way realizing what had to be done, and even though his job was to protect the structure, saying, "Don, we gotta do this." And I concurred with him, but you know, from his experiences and so forth, he saw the need to do that, and. And much more senior people than he, you know, hadn't quite occurred to them. Mm-hmm. When I say heroism, I guess heroism in the decision that they made. Our stop logs out here in front of the dam, we have some floating logs. And when this flood fight was underway and the water came up higher and higher and we realized it was going to go over the top of the dam, a young man who works for Lanny's Marine next door realized that those stop logs were blocking the flow of water over the dam because they were being pressed up against the dam, and jumped in our work boat, grabbed a couple of our employees, and here they were in this boat. It's a high-powered boat, but it was entirely reliant upon its engine, and he would back down towards the dam where the flow was going over something fierce, and grab hold of those, get a chain around those logs, with the water pummeling over the dam, and he's working right on the brink of the top of the dam, got a chain on him, and then tried to yank him off and away from that area. Got two of them out of there. The third one got jammed. People climbed out on that catwalk, and they had life preservers on, and we had ropes on them, but I mean, it was pretty flimsy. I mean, if that thing had gone, those guys would have been hurt badly or killed, but anyway, they actually cut those things. They were like 3 feet underwater, and they had a chainsaw with a long reach, and they were able to get down there and cut those logs up with this chainsaw and yank them out of there and get chains around them and yank them out of there with the powerboat. I mean, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I imagine you'd have to be somewhat skilled and still have to accept a little bit of risk to operate the chainsaw under such conditions too.
Yeah, you're standing on top of a catwalk across the dam that the water is surging over, and then down underneath you is the water, and then 3 feet below that, or actually maybe 2 feet below that, is the log that you got to cut to get out of there. And I mean, when you're paying someone not too much more than minimum wage and they undertake that kind of a project, just a good thing that OSHA wasn't involved, that our safety state safety advisors here in the state of Oregon, if they had seen this stuff going on, I mean, they would have gone ballistic. But it was just the kind of things that were happening during those events.
Mm-hmm.
These are not normal operating times.
Right. Needless to say.
Yeah, no. Well, there was $20 million worth of damage around the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of money.
Yeah. Now, you'd said earlier that there were maybe a couple of decisions that were made that turned out to be mistakes. Do any of those stand out in your mind?
Yeah, one in particular. The city of Lagos, we came by, and they were trying to figure out how to get water out of here, too. And they suggested that one way to do would be to cut a channel through our parking lot, kind of at the end of our dam. And the water then would exit through the channel. And it seemed like a good idea at the time. And so we authorized it. The city had a backhoe, and they began to dig a channel from McVeigh back towards our boat ramp, launching ramp area. And they dug the channel maybe 4 feet deep. And as they were digging the channel, of course, they dug through our water line. And then they dug a little farther, and they dug through our sewer line, and they dug a little farther, and they dug through our electric line, and they dug a little farther, and then they hit the dam. Well, what I didn't know and they didn't know is that our dam, the surface that you see of the dam extends easterly towards this area, but then as it approaches this area, it drops off, and it goes maybe 6 inches underneath the asphalt is a continuation of the dam. And so, of course, they were right at the very end of the dam, and there was concrete under there. And their equipment wasn't enough to get through that dam, but just enough to mess everything up. Well, when the water did overtop, the channel didn't really help to exit water any faster. But what happened is the water that was coming over the parking lot area got into the channel. And of course, the channel was now below the level of the asphalt. So instead of going right over the top of the asphalt and exiting out down below, it got into the channel and eroded out all the silt down in there. And then it began to erode in underneath the asphalt and eroded out to the west and destabilized the retaining wall that we had. And the retaining wall then gave way. Irrigated big holes underneath our existing parking lot to the point where three boats that were parked in, that had remained in the lot and parked in the lot, fell as much as 10 feet down into this irrigated hole, destroyed all three boats, took out our retaining wall. We had an 8,000 gallon fuel tank above ground. It didn't fall into the hole, but it was destabilized by the hole next to it, so it sank on one end. Fortunately, it did not break the fuel lines. Correcting that was probably a... I'm not sure how much of the work we'd have to do with or without that creek area that had been created, but ultimately we poured... $300,000 or $400,000 into our parking lot and new fuel tank, underground fuel tanks, and new retaining walls, and new sewer lines and water lines and electrical service and all the other stuff that was involved. And of course, it went right across our lot into McVeigh and destroyed McVeigh Avenue at this end of the bridge. I think the city had a $80,000 bill repairing the street. So that was probably a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it.
Dwayne Klein was supervisor of City Maintenance Services who suggested we do that, and we with a certain degree of fondness, we have called that Klein Creek that ran temporarily. So.
Well, it's now recorded for history.
Yeah, so, yeah, sure Klein Creek existed at one time, and so anyway, that was probably a bad decision.
Mm-hmm. right? But obviously you don't have time to necessarily consider all the pros and cons.
No, we made more good decisions than bad decisions, but that was a bad one. And but we are much better equipped for the next event. We know it's going to come. But the next time around, we got a head gate, which should hold. We've got additional discharge capacity. We've got a much stronger flume line. We've got a parking lot here that'll take a lot more than a flood like that to damage. We have flood insurance on our buildings now. We've done a lot of work down at the powerhouse. So when this occurs again, I'm hoping it won't cost as much money to repair.
Mm-hmm. What about yourself? You live right here on the lake.
Yeah, I do.
How are things at home during the
flood? Oh, things in the home front are just great. Our house is above the level of the flood, so our home wasn't damaged. We have a boat house down on the lake, and when the flood came up, I took a moment out, went over, and put on my hip waders, and walked out across my deck in about 4 feet of water. And took my boat out of the slip because what was happening is the boat was rising, and had it continued to rise, it would have pushed the windshield right up through the roof of the boathouse. That did happen a lot around the lake. So anyway, I took the boat out and tied it actually in an area where when the lake started coming down again, it would have been up on dry land, but then I took some time off again and kind of pushed it around, got it back in the boathouse, and then it lowered back into the boathouse just fine. So everything was waterlogged and damaged that was in the boathouse, but there was not a lot of damage. I fared a lot better than almost everybody else I know. There were other people whose whole houses, I mean, we have a number of people who $250,000 worth of damage was, you know, were the figures. Terrible losses.
Hmm. Yeah, it sounds pretty bad.
It was. We don't want a repeat of this.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else to say about the flood?
No. I guess there is one area which I think is worthy of a brief comment, and that is Lake Oswego Corporation felt very strongly that there should be a hydrology study in the Tualatin, and particularly when we weren't allowed to build our head gate any higher than it already is. We felt it was important that all of the agencies and communities get together and either sponsor themselves or cause the Corps of Engineers or some other entity to do a hydrology study and to determine the probabilities of this happening again. What can we do in the Tualatin Basin to reduce the damages that these kinds of events cause, make recommendations for preventing floods in the future? And it was very interesting. All of these little communities who would object to us putting in a higher head gate to protect ourselves, they didn't want to put in 10 cents to sponsor this hydrology study. It wasn't their bull that was gored, and they, on the one hand, said, no, they're not going to allow us to put up the kind of structure that we can protect ourselves, but they also didn't want to put up any money to mount a hydrology study. I mean, the damages from this flood were enormous. And we think they've got their head in the sand. It's not the kind of a thing, we're not even a part of that basin. And it's not the kind of thing that we have any authority on. It's not the kind of thing we have any authority on. But those that do have the authority, the flood is over and they're on to the next event. And so I think that's a frustrating outcome of this for us, is that we know what's going to happen again. And what surprises me is that an organization in the private sector is more concerned about the public good than the municipalities, particularly the city of Tualatin, and the city of River Grove. The private sector is more concerned than the public sector about protecting the public, and I find that an anomaly.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting too, because you say it's your bull that was gored, so to speak, but it's a pretty serious flooding in Tualatin as well.
Well, they did. They had tremendous losses, and we talked to McKillop, the city engineer over there, and I mean, it's like talking to a piece of Teflon.
Now, you said that your inability to build a higher head gate was frustrated by these communities?
Well, it requires their approval to build higher, and they wouldn't give their approval.
What difference would it make to them if the head gate were higher?
They would have additional 4 inches of flooding.
Oh, I see.
If the same event were to occur again, Tualatin would suffer from 4 additional inches. We would be protected. But they, instead of them getting whatever they got, let's say 8 feet in the downtown, they'd get 8 feet, 4 inches. But we would completely eliminate the flood damage here in Lake Oswego.
And this is your gate, your head gate would be higher?
Well, the head gate currently is 113.6. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was before the flood as well. It's all the higher we can build. The flood was 120.2. And we originally designed to build 121 feet.
Okay, and that would cause the 4-inch rise
in
the river.
And in effect, we would hold back it. The 120.2 would become 120.6 or 7. And that would cause additional height rise in the Tualatin River at that point, and then decreasing as you go upstream and decreasing as you go downstream.
Mm-hmm. Although, of course, the river could still flow downstream over your dam there, right?
Well, the river would continue to flow downstream, but in effect there was approximately 30,000 cubic feet of water per second passing by at that location. Mm-hmm. But 5,100 of that was diverted into our canal because we're too low.
So that would be 5,100.
That 5,100 would stay inside the Tualatin River.
And cause the river to rise 4 inches.
Exactly.
In the nearby communities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the arguments we mounted was, well, hey, look, our canal is not a natural canal. It's a man-made canal. I mean, if you were to go back to the way things were 150 years ago, there's no canal there. And so all we want to do is return it to its pre-human improvement status by going up to 121 feet. That is the level of the surrounding ground.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously.
But their argument is, no. When the floodplains were established in this area, or in this country, they were established on the basis of the way things are at the time the measure was taken. And at the time the measure was taken, the head gate was there. So it's a part of the basis on which the floodplains are determined. And that's an argument that we've been told, if we argued it, we would lose. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that to be true, we haven't argued it. But my feeling about the hydrology study is when the next flood occurs and everybody gets all damaged, and this time Tualatin will suffer again tremendous damages, we hopefully will suffer less because of the things we've done for mitigation. Maybe they'll listen the second time or the third time, or maybe they'll change administrators. Or maybe it'll happen so far in the future that this event will have been forgotten until someone pulls out this tape and says, you know, those guys back there in 96, they're right. We should do a hydrology study on the Tualatin.
Anything else about the flood?
No. I think we may have exhausted the topic.
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, there's one loose end I would like to pick up here. It's you know, a trivial point compared to what we've been discussing for the last hour and a half, but you brought it up a couple of times in the interview, made reference to it, and it's something that I haven't heard much conversation on, so if you could talk about it for a minute or two, I'd appreciate it. And that is that you mentioned that the high-tech industry that's gone in out in the valley is making its own contributions to pollution of the river that I believe you said you could see here in some of your measurements. And this is an opinion that is not too widely expressed. It seems like the what I usually hear is that they recycle the water at these chip making facilities, and that that they also have their own treatment of it, and that their discharges are fairly clean. So I'm just wondering, what do you see as a result of the high tech industry, and what do you think are concerns there?
Well, I think the high tech industry is a wonderful addition to our region. I probably have some opinions that with full employment, we don't need to incent these big plants to come into our region. I mean, look at the traffic in Washington, in our own community, everywhere. I mean, you can hardly move around. It's like gridlock here. And the idea of bringing more in and giving them these tremendous tax advantages, I just don't see it, because I'm the guy who I got to pay higher taxes because they pay less taxes.
Right.
So, but that's an entirely different argument than the water argument. The water argument is that whether it be high tech or any other industry, when they come in and they build impervious surfaces, there's fewer places for that water to go. So there's more water that gets into the stream flow, and it gets in there faster. That's why the Tualatin is beginning to flash. And by flash, I mean the front side of the bell curve that the river levels have when they rise. It's a kind of a bell curve shape. They, over time, they rise up and then they peak and then they come back down again on the back side of the bell curve. But the front ends of those bell curves are becoming steeper and steeper with each event. In effect, the rivers are flashing because there's no absorption, and there's not as much absorption into the soils they build all these surfaces. And then it's the building, it's the parking lot, it's the roads, it's the houses for people and the retail that serves them and all the other things that go with development. So more water gets into the streams and faster. The other problem I have with the accompanying that is, in the summer months, there's not enough water. This seems strange, but there's not enough water to supply these industries. They're big users of water, and they need quality water. So there are a number of moves afoot right now where they're building systems which will take water from the Coast Range, which would ordinarily flow down the Wilson River, for example, and they're building tunnels through the mountains, and they want that water to flow into the Tualatin Basin. And that's true on the Trask. I said Wilson, but I meant the Trask River. And there's another new project going in that's going to bring, I think it's 48 million cubic feet per day into the Tualatin Basin. A brand new big dam whose name escapes me, but the idea is, so...
Is this the expansion of the Barney
Reservoir? Yeah, the Barney Reservoir. Mm-hmm. And so now we have not only our own rainfall to cope with in these events, but we also have all this water that's being imported. I mean, it's exacerbating the problem. There's an incremental disadvantage during flood events to bringing all that water in, because it's got to go someplace. And then the other concern I have is that the discharges from these plants is worse than the water they take in. They degradate the quality of the water. The water coming out of those plants is not better than what goes into the plant. That water is used to wash off all kinds of things, including toxins. Now, I'm not saying that the toxic contaminants in those waters is dangerous to human life. at the levels that they're predicting, but I am saying that that water coming out of those plants is dirtier than the water that goes into those plants, because that water is used for cleansing. And so the Unified Sewage Agency has a number of concerns about this, and there's a lot of testing going on, and oh yes, you're safe, and so on, and maybe you're safe with each individual plant if it's monitored on a regular basis. But are you really safe when there's 20 plants or 50 plants or 100 or 1,000 plants that are all bringing in pretty clean water and discharging dirtier water? I think it's contaminating the system, and it will continue to do so. I think that the what we're going to discover 5 years, 10 years, is that we have maybe shot ourselves in the foot in terms of trying to continue progress on cleaning up the Tualatin, because of the nature of industry out there being unable to clean up after itself, and it's just going to discharge dirty water into the system, and I'll bet water quality degrades over the next few years. The answer to this is, of course, is at the extreme, is that becomes so bad that someone mounts a suit similar to what Northwest Environmental Defense League did in the Jack Chertle case, and they sue to cause the EPA to enforce the clean water standards, and until such time as those are accomplished, they put a moratorium on building permits in Washington County. I mean, to me, that is the real threat. Now, that's a extreme which I hope will not be reached, but it is a temporary solution to this increasing problem of water degradation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, well, any other...
Now you're getting political comments instead of actually what happened during the flood fight.
But, right, well, yeah, no, this yeah. is, we're off yeah. the flood now, I realize
but it's,
that.
But it's very tough to try and preserve the environment where man wants to place himself in great concentrations. Mm-hmm. And this is a wonderful area to live, and there's a lot of people who want to come up here. And one of the few savings graces that we have is urban growth boundaries. I think that urban growth boundaries are going to be tested for a long time, but I hope they stay in place, because it's one of the biggest protections we have. I think we can deal better with focusing our efforts in concentrated areas rather than allowing urban growth sprawl to just run rampant throughout our Tri-County area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked a little bit about that already, I think you're right, personally.
Yeah, yeah.
I give you two final questions.
Sure.
Here. One is there anything else that you can think of that relates to the history of the lake or the Tualatin that we haven't talked about yet?
Oh gosh, I don't know where to begin, and I don't want to go on forever. So,
okay, is there any other topic that we have, or any topic that we have discussed that you'd like to return to?
No, I think that this has been very interesting for me, in many ways, the manner in which you have led me through a recollection of my experiences has allowed me to kind of summarize and put into focus many of the things I've gone through the last several months, and I, in a way, I appreciate that.
Uh huh. Well, I'm glad to be of service. and of course, the interview will be available to you and your family if you wish to.
I probably one day would be interested in going down and saying, "My God, did I really do all those things back in '96?"
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for... Actually, you know, I've got just a little bit of tape left here. You told me a couple stories at the end of our session last time about your grandfather that we didn't tape. And I thought they were at least amusing stories.
Well,
About the robbery.
The robbery, the two robberies.
Right.
There was one I didn't tell too. Is a I'll tell you about the two robberies in a second, but I'll just tell you one that occurs to me at this moment. There was a friend of my grandfather. His name was Moody, and Moody had a tavern here in Lake Oswego. And Bill Blizzard was the editor of the Lake Oswego Review. And in those days, lawsuits for libel were few and far between. You could say a lot of things that you can't say today. And my grandfather tells me this story when this tavern was a pretty sleazy place, I guess, that Moody ran. So Bill Blizzard reported in the Lake Oswego Review that there had been some kind of a fight down at Moody's joint. And that was the word in the newspaper. And Moody took great exception to that, wrote a letter to the editor and said, "How dare you call my establishment a joint?" And I demand an immediate apology. And so Bill Blizzard, in his wisdom, the editor wrote back and said, he says, "Moody's right, and I apologize for calling Moody's dump a joint." But no, the two stories about my grandfather's bank was about those robberies was one time there was a group. It was about the time that Dillinger was running around the country and robbing banks, and there were a lot of wannabes, and one of the wannabes talked about it to the police, so they knew, or at that time the sheriff or warden here in Lake Oswego had found out about this proposed robbery of my grandfather's bank, and they came over and told my grandfather and the staff about it, and he said, "Now, you know, don't you worry, you know, we know this is going to happen, and it's supposed to be at 3 o'clock tomorrow, and so you just go about your business, and we'll take care of this." And so they were all nervous, you know, because here's the robbers were going to come at 3 was the word that had leaked out. And sure enough, just right before 3, this big car pulls up in front of the bank, and there's 3 guys in the car, but by this time the police department had organized itself with a couple of the local citizens, deputized them. And so as it pulls up to the curb, the police and the deputies, they just walk up and they have shotguns. In those days, everybody around here had a shotgun. There was a lot of bird hunting going on. And they just walk right up to the car and pointed their shotguns in through the windows and asked these men if they could help them. So I guess they helped them out of the car, and these guys were armed, and it was the group, and they were prepared to rob my grandfather's bank. But they never quite got to that point.
Were they arrested?
I don't know the story beyond that. I just have always been amused by the idea of deputizing, you know, local folk. This was in the late 20s, deputizing local folk and you know, walking up to a car with shotguns like that, and here's the big tough robbers inside. There's no place to go, and 4 or 5 guy, you know, kind of country boy farmers looking at them. Now, the other story about the bank, though, there actually was a robbery, there was a guy who was a good friend of my grandfather's, and he was frequently in the bank, and in a way, his name was Peanuts Didson. I never did know his first name, but everybody called him Peanuts, and he always had a lot of money on him. Everybody thought he was the guy that was going to get robbed someday.
And did you knew Peanuts personally?
He was elderly when I knew him as a kid. But anyway, the story goes that my grandfather was the guy in the bank at that time, the robbery occurred, and the robbers put him inside the vault and closed the door and spun the wheel. Shortly thereafter, Peanuts comes wandering into the bank, and my grandfather is yelling out, you know, "Get me out of here, get me out of here." And Peanuts says, "Charlie," his name was Charlie Sadlick, my grandfather, he says, "Charlie, is that you in there?" He says, "Yeah," he says, "get me out of here." And then he says, "Well, what should I do?" And he says, "Well, go around to the front of the vault and spin that wheel." And so he does that. He says, "Not doing any good." He says, "What?" He says, "What do I have to do?" He says, "Well, you got to turn the combination." And so Peanut says, well, what's the combination? And my grandfather says, you know, he says, I stopped because I didn't want to tell him the combination to the vault. But on the other hand, I was inside the vault. And he says, well, you got to promise to keep it a secret. He says, I'll keep it a secret. Just tell me how to get you out of here. And so my grandfather says, he says, I had to say it, and I said it just loud enough so he'd hear, and hopefully there's no one else in the bank. And he spun the wheel and get it out of there. And he says, I knew him real well, but I always knew there's at least one more person that knew the combination than me. I was nervous forever after that.
Question is, did Peanuts have a good memory, or did he run off to
Peanuts
overdo
a was
test?
A good guy. He wasn't going to use the information like that.
Well, Don, thank you very much for the interview. It's been, I think, a very valuable addition to the project, and I'm really glad that we were able to connect on this. So
I'm glad for it. Thank you a lot, Michael. I appreciate you coming by.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot.
Bye now.